From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe Past and Present. This year, 2011 and 2012, I'm a fellow at the Imre Kertész Kolleg in Jena, Germany. So I'll be conducting a series of interviews with other fellows and scholars passing through. So here we are in Jena, speaking with Joachim von Puttkamer, professor of East European history at the Friedrich Schiller Universität in Jena, and one of the two directors, together with Wojciech Borodziej of the Imre Kertész Kolleg, also here in Jena, in the former East Germany. The Kolleg is just a year old and has as its theme Europe's East in the 20th century. So we're going to talk some about the Kolleg, but also about Professor von Puttkamer's own work and thoughts on the field. He has many publications, among them a wonderful monograph on everyday schooling and national integration in Hungary, Slovaks, Romanians, and Transylvanian Saxons' engagement with the Hungarian state ideology from 1867 to 1914. This was published in German in 2003. He's also written a synthetic overview of East Central Europe for the 19th and 20th centuries. This was published in 2010 in German under the title Ostmitteleuropa im 19. und 20. Jahrhundert. And this work is especially noteworthy for its integration of the most recent historical scholarship on the region, and in my view, it's a pity that a similar volume does not yet exist in English. Finally, Professor von Puttkamer has also edited or co-edited a number of volumes on various topics, including most recently a volume on cultural orientations and societal structures in southeastern Europe, together with Gabriela Schubert, which was published in 2010. So thanks for agreeing to talk with me, Professor von Puttkamer. And I would like to begin by asking you a bit about your own path to the study of East Central Europe. Your first monograph from 1996 was on the regulation of factories in Russia prior to 1905. And I was wondering how you came to the study of Russia, first of all, and later to East Central Europe, and the particular questions you have engaged with since you entered the field.
Thank you. I actually came to study late Tsarist Russia, more or less, as is usual, by chance, by accident. I've started out studying modern history and economics in Freiburg, in West Germany, in 1986. And I was somewhat surprised finding that there was a side subject, East European history, which allowed me to learn Russian without having to study Slavic literature. It was the time of Mikhail Gorbachev. Russian courses were crowded. But interesting. I found this an ideal chance to get interested in or to develop an interest in Eastern Europe, which had been sort of closed to me. I'd never been there before. I didn't know any Slavic language. Mm-hmm. So I began learning Russian, and then a second impulse was that in German university, with its crowded seminars, the seminars on Russian history were rather small, and there was a direct approach to the professors, small groups. Freiburg was, and that was mere chance, I didn't know that before, was the place where the Handbuch der Geschichte Russlands, a very large project in the 1970s and 80s, had been prepared, edited by Gottfried Schramm in the third volume, which at that time dealt with the period from 1856 to the end of World War II. Mm-hmm. So that was actually the place where all questions relevant to late Tsarist Russia and early Soviet Russia were intensely debated. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the basic impulses by Gottfried Schramm to put the Tsarist Empire, Tsarist Russia, into its own right as a rapidly developing, modernizing European power. So when I had finished my regular studies, which I finished not at Freiburg but in London, I spent 1 year at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies, where I did an MA with a small thesis on the representation of Russian peasants in the Third Duma and their opinion on the Stolypin reforms. He suggested, Professor Schramm suggested, that I should write a PhD dissertation on the interaction between the Russian state and the emerging group of Russian entrepreneurs. He had somehow run into an institution called the Council on Trade and Manufacturing, which had been established in the early 1870s, where the state and chosen entrepreneurs debated central questions to the economic, of the economic policy of Tsarist Russia. And I quickly found that the sources were not really telling, and that I would have to approach this interaction between the state and the public and an interest group in a pre-constitutional system, not by looking at an institution, a sort of a pre-parliamentary institution, but at looking at a central topic where the state and the entrepreneurs had conflicting interests. So I began to look at factory legislation, which is a terminus technicus, one would say, because actually it's about workers' legislation and social policy. I later on insisted that the book should be named Fabrikgesetzgebung, Factory Legislation in Russia, because that's what it was, this policy, how this policy field was described in late Tsarist Russia, but had I named it Social Policy, the reception of the book would have been much better. Well, anyhow, so that's how I got to look at this a field which was not completely new. There was a broad Soviet literature on this field, which had always argued that the Tsarist government reacted to a wave of strikes since the 1880s, and that it had developed a rather paternalistic approach, specific authoritarian paternalistic approach to the workers. Looking at different parts of this legislation and going directly into the archives, which became much more accessible in the early 1990s, I simply marched into the Russian State Historical Archive in Petersburg, in the old Senate building at the time, in 1991, and said, "Here I am, what do you have?" And I was welcome. It was wonderful. It was cold, but wonderful. And I had a chance to look at all material pertaining to this legislation from the Ministry of Finances, and it quickly became obvious to me that the main impulse was to catch up with what at that time was perceived the most modern European legislation of the time. So the Russian state officials of the 1880s, 1890s tried to copy in a rather eclectic manner what they deemed most modern from Swiss, from German, and French and Austrian legislation, and to adapt it to Russian conditions. Mm-hmm. As far as the protective legislation, the regulation of child labor, female labor, working hours, and the development of a large labor code is a concern one can, or at least in my reading, one can see that Russia actually managed to catch up quickly to European developments, and that they also, that the Russian legislation was driven by an impulse to be modern, to be European, and to pick up what had been left undone in the great reforms of the 1860s. So pick up the leftovers, one could say. And it's only when new infrastructure and corporative institutions had to be built, corporate institutions for the workers, that is insurance against sickness, old age, and so on. That's actually when the Russian labor legislation got stuck, and there was strong conservative opposition saying, if we begin to constitute representative organs for the workers and to accept that there is something like workers as a social group in Russia, we constitute a problem which we think we don't have yet. And that's a problem which could not be solved before 1905, but which then was later on solved in the Duma period, when comprehensive workers' labor insurance was established in 1912. Mm-hmm. But that was too late to prevent the revolution. Oh. Even though I think it's a misunderstanding to think that successful labor legislation can prevent labor revolutions in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But that's a different matter.
That's a very big matter. one of the things that you mentioned early on is that, you know, you came to the study of Eastern Europe, and then you kind of flowed into the discussion of Russia. And as you know, in the United States, until recently, Eastern Europe and did not generally include Russia, although now it increasingly does, and particularly also former Soviet Union. And it makes me think of the ways in which the politics of the United States in particular has influenced our field. And I'm curious, therefore, as to whether you can offer any comment on your observations regarding the influence of German politics on the object that we study, if not through the way that we conceptualize the region or the way that the Germans conceptualize the region, then are there other aspects of German politics that have influenced the kinds of questions that get asked by historians in this area? Or is there a uniquely German political concern that is visited by historians of this field?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Eastern European history has been an established field, academic field, termed Eastern European history in German academia, at least since the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And it has often been argued that it's a product of the Cold War, studying the opponent. If that were true, this academic field would not have in no way fulfilled expectations, because what most historians, especially of Russia, which was the strongest field in that area, actually was far more sympathetic both to Tsarist Russia and to the Soviet Union than any Cold War studies ever, political expectations would ever have assumed. There has been a long debate in German historiography as far as the history of East Central Europe is concerned. In the German understanding, which has been shaped basically by Klaus Czernak in the late 1970s, Eastern Europe can be divided into the historical regions of Russia proper, or Eastern Europe proper, East Central Europe being basically Poland, Czech regions and Hungary, and Southeastern Europe, or the Balkans. There's a long debate on that. Czernak also tried to introduce a fourth region, Northeastern Europe, meaning the Eastern Baltic region. That's a different matter. And all these conceptualizations have been thoroughly debated since the late 1990s. But there has been a strong tradition of focusing in the 50s and 60s on the history of German minorities and German influence in the region, in East Central Europe and the Carpathian Danube region. There has been a debate in the late 1990s on the traditions of this so-called Ostforschung, which has actually been sparked by a monograph by Michael Burley, that is an English historian, but quickly been picked up by German historians. And now there, at the moment, there's actually a strong aversion of German historians working in this field in focusing on German-speaking ethnic groups and their history in this region. Especially by those historians who are drawing on the funds offered by the government for studying precisely this. So there's still a law dating from the 1950s and a lot of funding, which provides funding in studying the historical regions of former German settlements and the regions of expulsion of the Germans. And since the 90s, there's a strong consensus among German historians that being German is not a matter of academic study, to put it that way. It's not a criterion that one should get emancipated from these categories of the Ostforschung of the 1920s and 30s. And their problematic traditions. And that the Germans in the region should be studied like any other ethnic group in its constitution, its identity formation, and especially, of course, in its context within the larger social and political fabric of their regions of settlement.
So one of the things that strikes me about your work is how it's informed by historical scholarship from a variety of contexts. So in your work, I see the influence of the Anglo-American and also integration of the historiography from the Anglo-American context, from the East Central European context, as well as from the German context. And so I was wondering what you see as the various strengths and weaknesses of these academic cultures and historiographies, and what changes over time you've seen in the development of these historiographies, and, you know, do they run in parallel, are they divergent?
I'm not quite sure whether I've thought deeply enough on this question. Of course, I've been thinking a lot about the specific role of a historian studying countries, societies, cultures, not from within, but from abroad. In that respect, I would say there's I would like to make two basic comments. The first one is that there has been, until the end of the communist period, of course, a methodological difference, especially with regard to Russia, also parts of Czechoslovak history. And in that sense, German historians, as well as English-speaking historians as well, considered themselves to be the international community, and Russian, Polish, Czech, Romanian, Hungarian historians were considered to be those who would have to catch up in some way or the other. They have done so in many cases already since the 1970s, especially in Polish and Hungarian historiography. As far as Czech historiography, coming from dissident historians since in the Prague Spring and their rehabilitation in the 1990s, of course, as well. So there's no longer any reason for patronizing historians from the studied region as being in any ways backward, and maybe there never has been. Yet it is, I think it's quite interesting to see that as far as Russian and Soviet, especially Soviet history is concerned, the major debates, or most major debates, are sparked from the West and especially the English-speaking world. One thing which seems to me to be specific when looking from abroad is or from the outside onto Eastern Europe is a more comparative approach. There is actually there are different positions one can take. There are many colleagues who are themselves, for biographical reasons or whatever reasons, who understand themselves as interpreters between the culture they study and maybe even come from, and the German public. There are specialists for specific countries. There's a number of colleagues who are basically specializing either on Russian or on Polish history. And it's not by accident that this specialization takes place, especially with respect to the large countries in the region. There are some specialists on Romanian history as well. I don't think there's any specialist who could build an academic career on saying, I am the specialist on Hungarian history and nothing else in Germany. He wouldn't make it to a chair. And so, but of course, it's an approach which has to be respected in trying to say, I'm the one who reads all the Polish literature, and taking a somewhat broader view than the Polish colleagues themselves can do, but being part of the sort of being the ambassador to Polish historical culture in Germany or elsewhere in the West. The other approach would be looking in a more comparative way on the countries and the societies of the region than historians from the regions themselves usually do. I find this especially compelling with regard to Southeastern Europe when I'm speaking to Serbian or to Romanian historians for whom the point of comparison is always the West. And the question is it more France or more Germany or the US, the English-speaking world? And of course, when looking at the 19th and 20th century, they always find themselves or their society to be behind. And there's little sensitivity for comparing, for example, the development of Serbia and Romania, looking at similar developments, at divergent developments, and trying to make a balance sheet in what respect industrial development, economic development, for example, or political development, with respect to approaching or Europe has been more or less successful in this or that field compared to the neighboring countries, rather than stating again and again and again that there's a lack of civil society in this or that country with regard or to Germany or to France. So taking more comparative approach, I think, is necessary, and it's probably easier when looking from the outside, because since we are historians outside the region are of course usually at our university the only ones dealing with a huge region.
Yes.
And having to teach this in courses all the time, that is always astonishing to colleagues in Eastern Europe who are specializing on a century or on a decade on a specific phenomena. When I tell them that I'm the one at my university who's responsible for medieval Russia as well as for modern Kosovo.
It's a shocker, yeah.
That's how it is.
Yeah, indeed.
So one has it. One is compelled to take a broader view, and in designing courses and so on, and reading on a broader frame, and then broader as well, also compared to German historians studying German history.
That raises the question about the relationship of people who study Central Europe and of East Central Europe itself to people who study Western Europe or Western Europe itself. I mean, this is a historically, I mean, not necessarily fraught relationship, but it's oftentimes one of, you know, conversations. Like, we talk about nationalism, whereas, you know, Western European historians aren't preoccupied with this concern. Or we are obsessed, one might say, with borders, whereas Western European historians are less so in their treatment of their subject. And so I'm wondering, how have you, do you see any changes in regard to the relationship between people who study the region of East Central Europe or Eastern Europe and people who study Western Europe? Has there been a convergence that is in some respects the byproduct of the fact that, I mean, certainly it's more or less always been the case that East Central Europeanists have had to know something about Germany and something about Russia. And increasingly, perhaps something about France, something about England, something about Italy, whatever. Does this has this started to work both ways in the German context, or do you see a kind of European historiography emerging out of the transnational approaches of the more recent or comparative approaches of the more recent period?
First of all, let me say that in my view, one could no longer really speak about different national communities of historians getting into dialogue with each other. There's lots of commissions, Czech, German, Slovak historical commission, and so on. And of course, there is a specific responsibility for German historians in somehow coming to terms with the legacy of the 20th century, and especially, of course, of the German occupation of the region. But I do not see that there are any topics in this field where professional historians from Germany, from Poland, from the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, or so on, debate from a specific national viewpoint, which would be grounded in their specific in a specific national perspective. Most or almost all of the colleagues in Germany do not want to be in, sort of instrumentalized, made use of, or taken into a political position. And there's also, there are of course questions open to debate, but those are the debates where the lines are not along national background. The people involved.
That's less what I mean. The people who work on particular areas, whether they can talk to each other about common interests. I mean, whether, for example, conferences that get organized here that deal in some respect with the region also generally include people who work on Western Europe, because that perspective on a particular question is something that one feels like it should be talked about together, for example. I don't know, whatever the theme may be. Political radicalism, for example, or are there points of contact where you can see a European historiography emerging, one where, one, you know, not necessarily along national lines, but one that is where Europeanists are aware of the whole of Europe rather than just a particular part. Eastern Europeans work on their own, Western Europeans work on their own.
There's it's still, in a way, wishful thinking. there are some approaches where people are trying to study a phenomenon throughout Europe. And bridging Eastern and Western Europe. But I still have the impression that in most of the Western academia, the history, when they speak about Europe, they think about Western Europe, and Eastern Europe is there, but it's for the specialists. If German or Western historians of Eastern Europe are fully in contact with their colleagues from the region themselves, that's not European historiography as yet. Different approaches, for example, the book by Tony Judd on post-war Europe, are first signposts in the field. And it is, for the 20th century, it is of course fairly difficult to get an integrative perspective on European history. There are some studies in looking at transnational developments during the Cold War, of course one can find, especially in social but also in cultural history, in the development of the media and so on, one can find phenomena where one has to say it's the eastern part of Europe and communist Europe, communist-dominated Europe, is developing basically along the same social and cultural lines as Western Europe is, even though with a sort of a time lag in many respects. Looking at these phenomena is not an integrative European historiography as yet. I think there's still a long way to go. Which also has to do with the linguistic capacities. Whoever aims to write a comprehensive history of Europe has to draw extensively on secondary literature. In a way of handbook synthesis, synthetic approaches, there's more to be seen. But if one looks at monographic studies being written from studying the sources, it's very difficult. And the number of studies which are taking an integrative or at least a comparative approach across the East-West divide is not very large.
Well, and you know, you just mentioned the issue of linguistic competence, and this would speak to the potentiality that it has to be us, not them, so to speak, who starts with this. So why haven't we done it yet?
Why haven't we done what yet?
Oh, sorry. I think you're right that it has that you have to have these linguistic capacities in order to, you know, think about Europe in a big way. And right now, we are the ones who have those. I mean, I imagine you know English, German, probably French. Yes.
Probably.
And you know, if one knows French, one also knows Italian, etc. I mean, this is not true of people who work on Western Europe, and you know that they also know, you know, Russian, Hungarian, and you know who knows what else. And so, given that you know we've got the skill set, why aren't we making the first step in that direction? Do you think? I mean, because you mentioned the fact that you know we're not seeing, or that we're not seen by Western Europeanists, are we also not seeing Western Europe in the way that, you know, they aren't seeing Eastern Europe? Or do we consider, or do we think about our own field the way that they think about it, as something self-contained and that it's for specialists?
In a way we do, of course. because since there's the, as I said, the necessity to take a broad approach on more than one epoch and a comparative approach to different societies within the region, it's very difficult to take into account the huge literature which is written on German, on French, on Italian, on English history as well, and to try to integrate this into a larger narrative. So what usually happens is that at least German historians, as far as I can see, that applies to English-speaking historians as well, we do take into consideration sort of the main trends of historiography on Western European history, and trying to import whatever is helpful into our study of Eastern of the eastern half of the continent. But that's not, I mean, that's part of building European history. There's also.
So are you saying that we've kind of internalized the backwardness narrative?
No. No. not so, but I'm not quite sure whether the focus on, let's say, an approach to global history. That has not been developed by historians of Eastern Europe. It has been developed elsewhere and picked up by historians, by some historians of Eastern Europe, and trying to make use of it, and sometimes somewhat overemphasizing the range of this approach. But that's a different matter. And there's not very many fields where one would say the agenda setting is coming from those historians who are dealing with Eastern Europe. Maybe it was for a time when dealing with nationalism. Observation has often been made that most of the classical authors had a biographic background in the late Habsburg monarchy, or in the region itself. And maybe in a way that's also true for some aspects of what transnational history is about. One can say there's an agenda being set by historians focusing on Eastern Europe. More so probably when we're looking at what is termed new imperial history, but I'm not quite sure to what extent that has been picked up by historians of Western Europe. There are some. There has been a large project on the history of the European empires at Freiburg, which had been launched by Jan Leonhard, who is a historian of Western Europe who has strong interests in looking at the continent as a whole. But of course he always had to deal with the argument, does it really make sense to compare not only Russia but also the Habsburg monarchy with the British Empire? And what can be gained from comparing these empires, and including the Ottoman Empire as well? Comparing the continental empires without looking at the British or even the French case is much easier.
I'd like to ask to sort of switch gears now to the Collège, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how it came into being and why it's here in Jena, and maybe some of your hopes for its future or your how you see it developing in the future.
how did it come into being? First of all, the federal ministry offered the general framework and funding in calling for applications and offering to establish 12 so-called Käthe Hamburger colleagues, schools for advanced study in the humanities, to do something for the humanities in general and for the internationalization of humanities in Germany. There was no specific focus on any field of the humanities. What at Borodin, we developed this application. why it was approved. You have to ask the commission.
But how did you yourself, the two of you, come to this particular idea conceptualization?
One of the main ideas was that one has to argue not just with the subject, but with the people and the environment. And first of all, Rodrigo Borgia had been here in 2005. There had been established cooperation. He's one of the best-known specialists on Polish and German history in the 20th century, and is well-known within Germany as well. We actually said if we are to establish an international institute of advanced research, why not write an application which is international in itself, not only in its subject, but also in the way a Polish colleague and me are developing it. We're having at Jena. There's a very good environment with the chair for contemporary history, Norbert Frey, and the Jena Center, 20th century history he established here some years ago. And there's a close cooperation with Buchenwald and its director, Volkart Kriege, and its focus on what in German is Geschichtskultur. Difficult to translate precisely because there's a huge debate on what is precisely meant by Geschichtskultur. But in a way, it's cultures of memory. And focusing on Eastern Europe, which I think also helped us very much. And of course, was the commitment of the university as a whole to focus more or to develop a perspective on Eastern Europe from Jena. The basic idea of the colleague is to establish a place where historians and colleagues from related fields can join and find space and calmness, one could also say, but also inspiration to work on larger projects of their own and to get into dialogue and speak about the projects with other colleagues within the field. Basically from all over the world, it boils down, of course, to colleagues from Eastern Europe, from Germany, and from the English-speaking world. We had an application from Argentina by a researcher who was interested in Southeastern Europe, but the project was not convincing enough, to put it that way. In the end, we had a very large number of applications to our last call. But of course, we would be delighted to have colleagues from other regions of the world who are interested in Eastern Europe as well. Mm-hmm. So academic background in itself is not a criterion. Mm-hmm.
And so could you talk a bit more about how you see it going into the future, the things that you would like to see it do over the coming years?
One thing it already does is to establish a way of networking among colleagues from different regions, getting to know each other who somehow didn't know each other yet, often because they're working on different regions of Eastern Europe and they're finding out here that they're working on similar issues. Mm-hmm. We're having a close cooperation with the Herder Institute in Marburg, which is a very, very good library, the best probably in Germany, on Eastern Europe, north of the Carpathian Range. that is the Czech Republic and Slovakia, Poland, and the Baltic countries, basically. And we can order books from there and they're here within a day, actually. And that is, I was really surprised when one of the people working there said it's only via the Imrikatis colleague that our Herder Institute is now getting known to some colleagues from the English-speaking world, where the Herder Institute is not as well known as it is within Germany or in Poland or Latvia or Estonia. Mm-hmm. What I also hope for, of course, that the fellows working here are not only establishing contacts, but are also take the chance to see their project within the larger framework and transcending the sort of the focus on specific country. In getting a better understanding how their specific project links up to larger questions which have to be addressed in an integrative perspective on the entire region, or Europe as a whole, actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, we also invite fellows who do not need any help in this respect at all. but one can also see that for some colleagues, for some of the fellows, it's rather a new experience to speak or to try to explain their project to colleagues who are not working in neighboring countries, but in countries neighboring their neighbors, from a little bit farther away. We have centered the research interest for projects to be done at the Collegium around five different areas. That is war and violence, development of statehood and state institutions, economic and social history, dealing in some way with modernity, and understanding different understandings of modernity in the 20th century, what has been termed intellectual horizons, and cultures of memory. Those are these five fields, and what we're trying to or planning is to develop comprehensive volumes who are collecting and focusing research in these fields, showing the state of the art in a comparative perspective.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to something that you said earlier about the role of some historians as kind of mediators, mm-hmm. and it made me think or wonder, essentially, how you see your own role as a historian. Mm-hmm. I know that you've worked on Hungary, and that you're probably watching Hungary now relatively mm-hmm. closely. I imagine because you're involved in cultures of memory mm-hmm. that you're involved, or the Kollég is mm-hmm. involved in any number of projects related to, you know, memory on the ground, mm-hmm. as it were. And I'm wondering how you conceive of your own role as a historian in our time, you know, of this region. Do you see yourself as in part both historian and activist in a way? Or, you know, where do you see, or where do you wish to see the greatest impact for your work?
Well, there's of course always the hope that one can influence the subject one is studying, which is of course a problematic approach in a way. When I wrote this book, this on schooling in Hungary, of course I somehow cherished the hope that it could contribute in defusing Hungarian Slovak or Hungarian Romanian tensions, at least in a way. I haven't given up that hope as yet, but it probably takes longer than my lifespan to develop this potential. So But also because I had the hope that as someone who is not coming from historical Hungary at all, that is not from any of the German groups, Saxons, Transylvanian Saxons, or Banat Swabians or so on, I could take something which would be perceived as a somewhat neutral perspective on linguistic conflicts in the late 19th century, and getting out of the trap of either condemning or justifying Hungarian language policies around 1900. And I'm still confident that in the long run, not just professional historians, but also a larger public will be able to take a more calm, a more historical approach to past conflicts. But that takes its time, and whether this book can contribute to that is open to debate in some decades from now. what we're doing at the moment, basically, where it's very difficult to make a distinction between a scholarly approach, just watching or studying developments and trying to influence them, as far as especially as memory culture is concerned, is we've been looking at the development of and of different museums of the 20th century, that is museums dealing either with World War II or with communism, which is a very interesting field and a very problematic field, and where especially scholars from Germany are always having to justify themselves against an approach that they're trying to export German forms of looking back at National Socialism into the way the Hungarian or the Polish or the Russian public is looking back at communist dictatorship. But in a way, there is of course the expectation that it is in some way possible to support the development of standards of democratic reflection on problematic periods of history within the countries themselves, or at least to establish some sort of sensitivity among among the colleagues working in that field in the countries themselves to many of the problems connected with the way museums work in trying to impose a certain view of history onto their society. What we are trying to do now is not to educate somehow backward colleagues from working in museums in Poland or Hungary, which is of course meant ironically, but in trying to help them or to establish a broader dialogue among colleagues working in that field from different countries. Because one can say that this is a field where historians and museologists in all the countries involved, including Germany, articulate a need for dialogue. There's very few chance actually to stimulate such a dialogue on essential questions on how to deal with historical objects in museums, for example, and how can museums support not only national consciousness but also a democratic stance or a civic stance within a larger public? How can historical museums fulfill professional standards and still be attractive to generations socialize in the new media. Do museums really have to look a war movie, like the Museum of the Warsaw Uprising does, if it wants to be attractive to a larger public? And it is very attractive to a larger Polish public. So what we're trying to do is to foster a debate on crucial and central questions. And there's always the tension that if you look at it from Germany, there are striking similarities in these discussions throughout the entire region, from Estonia and its Baltic neighbors, through Poland to Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, whereas historians and museologists working there see themselves once again in perspective to the West, and do not wish to be put into the Eastern European perspective by Westerners. So they're not so interested in, let's say, Polish colleagues are not so interested in debating the problems of similar museums in Budapest or in Riga, but would rather debate the problems they have in perspective to museums in Berlin, London, and Washington.
I have just one more question, and it relates to one of the most delightful features of the Collegue as I have observed it, and that is that it brings together both very young scholars, recent PhDs, and also very senior ones, and so it really runs the gamut in terms of age and experience. And in the short time that I've been here, it's become clear to me how seriously you in particular take the scholarly future of the next generation of scholars of East Central Europe. And so, in regard to the future, I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about what kind of work you find the most exciting in our field right now, and what opportunities and challenges do you see ahead for the next generation of scholars?
Broad questions.
Yes.
Of course, there's still the large and overwhelming and unresolved question the experience of dictatorship in Europe in the 20th century, and relating National Socialist and Stalinist experience to each other. What do they have in common? How do they link up to each other, especially in those regions which had to suffer from both? Questions which Timothy Snyder has recently addressed in his Bloodlands. And I think there's an enormous challenge in seeing the similarities in phenomena, but also having to understand that there, these similar phenomena, especially of violence, take place in different social contexts, and that a similarity in these expressions of violence violent dictatorship does not always link back to similar causes. that is certainly one challenge. Another one, which links to the questions the colleague is interested in, is to reassess again and again the experience of interwar Europe and the failure of democracy throughout most of Europe in the 1930s. And another challenge which I'm beginning to work on myself a little bit more is in trying to put the experience of 1989 and the fall of communism and the beginning of transformation into a more historical perspective. Most of the work which has been done on the late socialism ends in 1989, At the moment I see basically it's only those people who are working on the reconceptualization of national history after 1989 and in assessing the communist period and linking that to debates which began already in the 1970s and 1980s. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in more at the moment is how the debates of the 1990s in other fields as well, economic fields for example, social policy and so on, also link back to the earlier experiences. One can say the way toward the revolutions of 1989 has been different in every country, so why shouldn't the development afterwards be different as well? And how do these link up to each other? Well, we've become accustomed to looking at these transformation countries as a whole, starting from zero in many policy fields. So and of course it hasn't been that way.
Is this a monograph you're working on?
It might become one at the moment. I started out in doing an article which is to be published soon on strategies or conceptions of privatization and how they developed in different opposition circles in Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia in the 1980s. On the history of sociology as not only as an academic field but also in conceptualizing society and the changes in society since the late 1950s in East Central Europe. To what extent different approaches to this broad field will condense into a monograph is something which depends on how much free time I will have myself and not just the fellows at the Colleague in the years to come, and to what extent will also depend on the inspirations. Of course, I myself also get in speaking with the fellows and, on their projects and their perceptions on larger developments in contemporary history in the countries they come from or they're studying or both.
Well said. I think on that note, we it's very positive. So thank you very much.